Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the program. It's really nice to have you with us. Leading up to June 4th, we're going to be presenting a series of special programs on the media in China and what it's like working on the media in China. 2 years ago, we ran a documentary produced and presented by Richard Adie from ABC Radio National on the ABC's opening of their first foreign bureau in China. It also covers what it is like today. So today, for this special edition of the program leading up to June the 4th, we're going to rebroadcast that because if you listen to it carefully, you can find that it's not just the ABC that has difficulties, but also other international media as well. Here's Richard Adie.
The ABC opened its bureau in Peking, as it was, in 1973, after Gough Whitlam had recognised China, but before he arrived for an official visit.
That's the sound of thousands of Chinese children here at Peking Airport this afternoon, saying goodbye to Prime Minister Whitlam and the Australian Party travelling with them. What they're calling out is a warm send-off to Prime Minister Whitlam and a warm send-off to distinguished Australian guests. All around the tarmac here in Peking Airport is a blaze of colours.
Paul Raphael, the ABC's first on-the-ground correspondent in China, and a man who'd been absolutely determined to get that job.
I was at Whitlam's place in 72, December, when he won power. Then he came from the motel and, I mean, you couldn't do it now, but with the security, all the nonsense, but you're just in the house and there were a couple of hundred supporters and whatever. And within, I don't know whether it was the next day or fairly quickly, he announced recognition of People's Republic of China. At that point, I definitely knew somebody was going to go from the ABC and open the bureau up there because it was a prestige thing, it was symbolic, all those things. So I decided that I was going to be it. So they announced that there'd be a reciprocal exchange of reporters. So that's how they did it, you know. The Chinese wanted to get their new China news agency people into our countries because they were spooks. But our people wouldn't let them come in here unless we were given slots there. So they came up, they were going to have three, ABC,
Sydney Morning Herald,
AAP, and Sydney Morning Herald. So I did something I'd never done before, but about a few days after they announced that the ABC would have a correspondent in Peking and open the bureau, I took, again, maybe it doesn't sound unusual now, but then with a kind of the hierarchy and authority or whatever, I took a deep breath one day and wrote a letter to Duck Manton, who you probably know is the general manager.
Yes.
And I wrote to him, and I said, I'm the best person for the job. And I said, I've, you know, Parade magazine and this and Sunday Times in London have all printed my stories, and my wife's Chinese and I'm willing to learn Chinese. And so I'm the best person. But a week later, Russell Warner called me and said, you really want to go to China as the correspondent? He said, you're mad. He said, you won't be able to report very well there. And he was right, but I didn't care. What I wanted to do was be there. And whatever I could report would be valuable. And he said, you want it? I said, yeah, really. He said, I'll arrange it for you.
On arrival, he quickly realised how difficult reporting would be. And I should tell you, the sound quality of this next bit is not the best.
They're about deaf phones. I know that from two reasons. Once, when the apartment were nearly ready, they allowed my wife to go down and have a look. And she noticed that the door down to the basement was open. So she looked in and she saw all these cubicles. They were not so much concerned about us, they were concerned about the diplomats we shared the building with. During one of these dinners, and they were the only times that we were able to talk to the Chinese, was the foreign ministry, apart from the two trips we had every year, the foreign ministry. And one day, Mr. Shou, who was, Ma Yuchen was in overall control of the 10 or so foreign correspondents, Mr. Shou was the Australian correspondents, and I think. And one day, just to show off, at one of these banquets at the Great Hall of the People when a leader would come in. He just let slip something to me. The only way he could have known that was by bugging me. And then he smiled at me. No, he burst out laughing.
Some things never change.
I work on the assumption that I'm constantly being monitored. So, for example, we assume all our emails are being read or can be read. Phone calls can be listened into. Even that the car, the ABC car and the ABC office and my house would all be bugged. Now, I don't know the extent to which any of that is true, but you have to work on that assumption. And if you were ever dealing with something that was particularly sensitive, you'd find another way of talking to that person, not using your phone, not using emails. The reason we think this is the case is because there have been numerous times when, you know, I've sent off an email and then, bang, the authorities have been straight back in touch with me. The only way they would have known that is if they'd read the email. Or we go to some remote village and we're covering a sort of dispute over this sort of toxic pollution where people there were dying of cancer. The villagers wanted to talk to us, and in the middle of nowhere, these police and government officials all just turn up there. Now, the only way we thought that they could have known we were there is by probably like tracking our phones. There's a theory going around, actually, that we have these press cards you have to have, like it's an identification. Some of the correspondents think that maybe they've got microchips in them, and that way they could just track us wherever we went anyway. So even if we didn't turn on our phones, they could follow us.
Stephen McDonnell. After Paul Raphael, the next correspondent was Warren Duncan. Here he reports on the funeral of the Premier, Zhou Enlai.
In a ceremony unannounced to foreigners, we saw what amounted to the funeral procession of Mr. Zhou Enlai. A motorcade of about 86 vehicles, one of which was a small bus, obviously contained the body of Zhou Enlai. As the motorcade passed along Peking's main boulevard, something like 100,000 people stood and watched in silence. Many of them were openly weeping.
Today, Beijing is one of the most sophisticated cities in the world. But in the mid-1970s, it wasn't such an easy place for a foreigner to live, especially if you didn't speak Mandarin.
I had a very, very good interpreter. It was incredibly professional. And just a maid who was also very good, a bit older and very experienced and remembered the old days. She had worked in a hotel in Tianjin before 49. So she had an idea about foreigners, Westerners' needs and wants. So in fact, she was quite useful because she knew, she just had some idea, whereas a younger woman wouldn't have had any idea of what a cocktail party was or what a dinner party was in our sense. And of course, those things were terribly important. What I used to say was there was the entertainment was entertaining. There was no entertainment at all. There was nothing that, you know, we would want to watch or would be entertained by on television. There were no movies to go to. This was the very beginning of videos, and a few people used to get them, and a couple of people had machines. Occasionally you would get to see what was being shown on television in some other part of the world. So entertaining social activity was incredibly important, so having good staff around was useful for that as well.
One problem was that at the time, all Chinese were encouraged to monitor everyone else's behaviour and report on them to the authorities.
And they had this criticism of people who fawned on foreigners. That was a very, very naughty thing to do, and you could be reported for fawning on foreigners. So if you were to give people something from outside, they could be criticised and maybe lose their job or be moved to somewhere awful. So that was a delicate balancing task. It was one of the things I enjoyed in the latter part of my time there when, after the dismissal of the so-called Gang of Four, who were seen as the hardliners and the supporters of Mao, there was a great freeing up. And during my last months, I was able to really enjoy the company of those three people. And by then I could communicate pretty well and we could go to lunch all together and really enjoy that experience. So that was actually one of the real delights of staying long enough to see the beginnings of change.
In 1983, Elaine Chung took over as bureau chief. Here she reports on the expulsion of a fellow foreign correspondent.
Officials have opposed a normal contact between foreigners and locals and tried to restrict foreigners to special compounds. Some of Terzani's writing was highly critical of the totalitarian regime. One report was about his children's experience in a Chinese school, where they're said to have been systematically segregated and observed. When asked yesterday whether Terzani was on the list of unfriendly journalists, a foreign ministry spokesman said, "I guess you can make your own judgment."
Helene Chung was actually the first woman the ABC sent overseas as a foreign correspondent, and she naturally wanted to do well. And there was other, more prosaic pressure, too.
I also had, when I arrived, the problem of having to totally refurbish the apartment after 10 years, because China was a very costly place. I think the figure given to me at the time, or I learnt, was in the order of a quarter of a million or so a year it cost in Beijing. Now, unlike today, where everything is made in China, nothing made in China then worked. Nothing made in China could be used in a bureau. You could not even get envelopes that you could lick. You had to use a pot of paste. Even stamps had to be pasted on with glue. There was no such thing as carbon paper. Now, maybe you've forgotten what carbon paper was, but this was not when everyone used a computer. There was no such thing as a fax machine. Faxes came out in 86 or so. However, they were not in China then. We used a telex machine. That was the form of communication. So everything was pretty backward. I mean, you couldn't have a Chinese-made typewriter. You couldn't have a Chinese-made anything. So all the equipment, even the paint, the carpet, the refrigerators, the stove, everything had to come up from Hong Kong. And the reason the refurbishment had to be left to a new correspondent was it would cost the ABC an arm and a leg, a couple of arms and legs in duty, if it came in of its own accord, not with a newly appointed correspondent.
Refurbishing is something you eventually finish. Other problems you have to wrestle with every day.
It was necessary to go through a Chinese operator to get a line to Sydney. And the lines were so poor, I had to shout to be heard. Everyone had to shout. That's why everyone in China shouts, or one of the reasons. And I would sometimes shout for up to 5 hours through a series of operators, because I'd lose one. I'd finally get through to Sydney. The technician would say, the line's no good. I'd have to go back, wait in my queue, shout through the operator, get through. This would sometimes take 5 hours before I got a line that was almost acceptable for a piece on air. In fact, I shouted so much, I regularly lost my voice. And one year, I lost my voice 5 times. And the newly appointed Australia doctor based in China said, if I didn't watch it, I could lose my voice permanently. Well, clearly I didn't, but so I was very lucky. Now, that, of course, has changed, because there's no problem in communication with China in any form now, even television, instant through to Australia and elsewhere.
It isn't quite as simple as that, of course. Stephen McDonnell.
Most of the gear, you know, of course we've got sort of modern gear these days, and it works a treat when it works. The biggest problem is internet speeds, especially if we're on the road. Like now, if we hit somewhere, the first thing we'll try and do is test the internet speeds in the hotel, for example, because you have to be sending all this material back el pronto. Like, they expect it potentially within minutes, depending on where you are. And so we're battling that internet speed all the time, even in the bureau. What makes it even worse is that to get around the so-called Great Firewall of China, you need to use a virtual private network, a VPN.
Yeah.
So to look at any sites that are blocked, you know, anything or not be subject to Chinese censorship. You need to use this. Again, this slows down the computer speed. So this is our biggest headache. It's computer speed. And that means logging on and looking at websites, or it means filing via FTP, because we file over the internet these days. Even from the bureau, we file from the internet. So that's our biggest headache.
Actually, that speed, the other side of it, of course, is that you are expected to file a lot more than previous correspondents.
Sometimes we joke about this, that our bosses, when they're all in the field, they never had to do it, but they expect us to. But, for example, you know, recently we had a big court case that we had to cover. Now, we're expected to do, well, let me think, 7 radio news stories, 2 or 3 radio current affairs stories, a 7 p.m. and a late line television story, then possibly a bit of a rant, as we call it, where we're just talking to the camera for News 24, and any other crosses to, it could be anything from Metro Radio to News Radio. Then by the time we've done all of that, we start working on the AM piece for the next morning. And that's without even filing to other platforms like the internet, for example, the ABC website. They'd love us to write articles for them, but we just don't have time to do it.
The explosion of demands on correspondents in terms of the different outlets they have to service really began in the 90s. Jane Hutchin arrived in Beijing in 1995. She'd grown up in Hong Kong, was fluent in Cantonese, and had learnt Mandarin. But as you'll hear, knowing the language will only take you so far.
This is quite bad, but I know there's worse pollution further down the road. I don't understand why we're coming to the electricity plant. Why won't you let me choose the place myself? Well, if there's nothing to see, then why can't we look for ourselves? What is the problem?
That's from a foreign correspondent story in 1996. Getting it was hard work.
We ended up finding this locality along the Huai River that, you know, literally the river there had gone black and it was dead. And to actually get to talk to those people, though, because when we were with the officials, the buses would go speeding past these very black bits. And we were very lucky one day because we were actually held up by a massive traffic jam because there was some kind of road work going on. So we said, oh, we'll get out here and start filming. And before they could stop us, we were out filming. A massive group of locals had gathered around us and they started complaining about the government and said, does the government see what they're doing? And what about our lives? We can't live if the river's dead. There's no fish, and they took us down. And indeed, the river was bubbling. It was that kind of disgusting. It was just bubbling. And we filmed it because they couldn't really stop us. You know, they were calling people on their phones, but they couldn't really stop us because it had just happened. But then the shutters came down and they didn't really want to take us to the factory that we'd asked to go, the factory that was causing a lot of the pollution. And so we had already brought with us a small digital camera. And what we tried to do was to contact the people that we wanted to speak to and go and visit them in the evening where, you know, say goodbye to the officials after our nice big banquet, go home, say we're very, very tired, it's 6:30, oh, we're so tired, we want to be ready for tomorrow, and then we'd jump in a taxi and go out and film the people that we wanted to speak to. And they were on to us, of course, and they realised when we all sort of got out together, even though we weren't carrying a big camera with us, that we were up to something. So that's what happened. There was a taxi chase through a very, very crowded small city, in and out of markets. Then we would jump out, we would separate. It was a real hullabaloo. We eventually did manage to shake our tail and speak to some people who had lived by the river, who collected the water for us to show us what, you know, they were having to live by because they didn't have tapped water then. And it made a fascinating story, but of course the officials were not pleased.
And if you displease someone official, you had to atone, sometimes by writing something called a self-criticism.
It never happened to me in the foreign ministry in Beijing itself. I wasn't told to write one there, but in smaller municipalities, I was made to write several self-confessions. Now, I didn't have a big problem with this because I knew that my role as the leader of the team was to take the responsibility. So if I made it all my fault, that means that our Chinese assistants who worked for us would not be punished because it was me, their leader, telling them to do something, and none of the other team would be responsible because I was the evil person that ordered them to do this thing. So that's really what it was about, just to say that I was responsible. I told them to go out on the street and film this protest or this disgusting water, and I take responsibility for this.
Some things haven't changed about China over the last 40 years. Some things have changed enormously. And the ABC correspondents have changed too. The early ones didn't have Mandarin. Now they do, which makes an enormous difference. Though it doesn't mean there isn't room for confusion. Stephen McDonnell.
Well, these days, Beijing is a big modern metropolis, and they are used to foreigners there, and they're also used to foreigners who speak Chinese. So with white face, you can get into a cab and start talking to a cabbie in Mandarin, and they won't think it's weird. But if you were to leave, say, Beijing, Shanghai, or Guangzhou, and go to smaller places, it would still freak them out a bit. Wow, not only a foreigner, but a foreigner speaking Chinese. So those big metropolises, you know, you can get any sort of food you would want. It's like being in Sydney or Melbourne or something like that. And they're quite sophisticated places. But the further you leave the big cities, the more strange it would be to someone to encounter a foreigner.
And so you have to kind of get around that, whoa, I'm freaking you out, but I want you to talk to me.
Well, it's funny sometimes. I remember I once went up to a lady just selling fruit, like sort of little old lady had a stall. And this was actually just on the outskirts of Beijing, but it's a real knockabout part of town and where local villagers who live on the outskirts of Beijing come and buy their fruit and things like that. And I just wanted to do a little interview with her. And so I came up and I start asking her questions, and she looks at me and she's just speaking at 100 miles an hour, telling me, you know, I can't speak English, blah, 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 or I can't speak your language. She's just firing. And I'm just trying to get her to calm down and say, listen, I am speaking your language, okay? That wouldn't have, you know, occurred to her that a foreigner could possibly speak Mandarin. Yeah, so it is quite funny in that way.
Stephen McDonnell, still right in the middle of things in Beijing. Jane Hutchin finished at the beginning of 2001, wrote a book about her experiences, and then took up big postings in the Middle East and London. So how does she look back on her time in China?
Well, level of satisfaction, it was the best, so I'd have to say 10. Degree of difficulty, it was also very, very difficult, so probably a 9.5 to 10 in terms of how hard it was. But it was such a great time. It was pre a lot of the amazing technological advances that we have now. I mean, we used to have to drive, for example, 45 minutes through traffic, an hour through traffic, just to get our tapes to be able to satellite them back to Australia. Now they're done in the bureau with a push of a button. So it was a very different time. But I appreciate that because, in a way, I got to see China before the whole gloss of the Olympics arrived. I think I got to see a real nation that was in the throes of an incredible reform.
The difficulties and challenges of working out of a foreign bureau in China. It was produced and presented by Richard Adey, and they were talking about the early days of the ABC's bureau in China and what it's like today. And that's a rebroadcast of a documentary that we ran 2 years ago. Leading up to June 4th, of course, we will have some other special programs, so definitely stay tuned. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
Hi, this is Ian McFarland. If you're an SWL and feel nostalgic for the good old days of shortwave, you'll be interested in three sets of CDs that Colin Newell and I have produced. The first gives you 100 idents and interval signals from stations around the world. Then there's the foreign language recognition course that will help you identify the myriad languages that you can hear on shortwave. And the newest CD set, a look at the past 20 years in shortwave broadcasting with some of my broadcasting colleagues, and a look into the future. The proceeds from the sale of these CDs are in aid of a charity, a food bank for the less fortunate in my city of Duncan, British Columbia in Canada. Learn more about these CDs on the dxr.ca internet website. That's dxer.ca. Good listening, everyone.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Charlie 105, it is PDF to Toto Journal.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Well, it's now time to turn our attention to propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect over the next 7 days. And here's a man to tell us all about it. Some people think that he lives in a radio, but he doesn't. But he does talk about it a lot. It's our own Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through May 14th. Normal at all latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through May 14th, magnetic conditions unsettled to quiet. Shortwave fade-outs unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through May 15th, solar activity very low, geomagnetic activity mainly quiet, occasionally unsettled. No solar radiation storms expected. From FK Jana in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to unsettled on May 13th, 21st, 23rd to 25th. Mostly quiet on May 14th, 18th, 22nd, 29th, and 31st. Quiet to active May 15th, 19th, and 20th. Quiet on May 16th, 17th, 26th to 28th, and June 1st. Active to disturbed on May 30th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field activity reaching G1 minor storm levels likely on May 20th, with ANK indices of 15 and 5. May 29th at 25 and 5, June 4th, 30 and 5. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 on May 14th, 17th, 18th, 22nd, 23rd, 25th, 26th, 27th, 31st, and June 1st. Solar flux dropping from a peak of 95 on May 15th to a trough of 82 May 18th to 22nd. Be on the lookout for sporadic E reaching the lower TV and FM bands all week. William Hepburn's VHF UHF DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting May 13th and 14th off Baja California. May 18th further south along the coast of Mexico, off the coast of Angola May 14th, extending to Namibia from the 15th. Extreme to extremely extreme all week along the Red Sea and across the Arabian Sea.
All right. And with that propagation forecast from Glenn Hauser, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you all, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. 73 and 88 to the ladies.